Politics Uncensored with Ali Milani on FUBAR Radio.
Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of Politics Uncensored. I am your host, Ali Milani, and we have a packed show for you today with some really, really big, heavy-hitting guests. Joining us later, we'll have Lord Heseltine, former Deputy Prime Minister under John Major. Christine Jarding will be joining us, Liberal Democrat MP for Edinburgh West. And in the studio, we have Rayhan Uddin, journalist from the Middle East Eye. Now, regular listeners will know we begin the show every week with the top stories of doing the rounds. And last week we spoke to Michael Crick, and one of the things we spoke about at the end of the interview was our joint love for the club Manchester United and our dread of Manchester City winning a treble. While I'll try as best I can to ignore the achievements of Manchester City, we do begin this week's Unwrapped with breaking news. So 14 minutes before we came live on air on FUBAR Radio, Reuters has reported exclusively that English football club Manchester United is negotiating granting exclusivity to the consortium led by Qatar's Sheikh Jassim bin Hamad Al Thani in the talks to sell itself for more than $6 billion. Now, the Glazer family, which bought Manchester United all the way back in 2005, leveraging the club, placing hundreds of millions of pounds of debt on the club, having spent nearly nothing on the club, taking over $1 billion of money out of the club, are now going to sell it and make a whopping profit for $6 billion. But it's not just Manchester United. We have seen Saudi Arabia with its public investment fund buy Newcastle United. We have seen players from Cristiano Ronaldo to N'Golo Kante to Karim Benzema going across to Saudi Arabia to play football in, let's be honest, not an elite league as is commonly known, but big names going across. And now something has happened in the golfing world. So LIV Golf has merged with PGA Tour, with the Saudi Public Investment Fund being one of the main investors. That is why we have Rayhan Uddin, journalist from Middle East Eye, joining us in the studio. Rayhan has done a lot of reporting on sports washing, on the impact of particularly Middle East states investing, buying sports clubs and their strategies on sports in general in the West. Rayhan, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
First of all, I'll be honest with you, man. I don't watch a whole lot of golf, right?
I'll be honest, neither do I.
Neither does anyone under the age of 68. Can you I'm going to get cancelled by the golf community, don't care. Explain to me what has happened with LIV Golf, PGA Tour, and why it's such a big deal.
Sure. What LIV Golf is, it emerged around 2 years ago as a rival to the PGA Tour, which is the main organizer in the sport of golf. Its main source of funding is Saudi Arabia's public investment fund, which is the sovereign wealth fund of Saudi Arabia.
Mm-hmm. And that comes directly from the Saudi state. This isn't private individuals with money. This is money from the state.
Exactly. The chair of Saudi Arabia's public investment fund is the Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Salman, and the vast majority of the board members of the public investment fund are sitting government ministers in the Saudi government. So, contrary to what Newcastle United may have claimed in recent years about there being a separation between the public investment fund and the Saudi government. Yeah.
It's the same sort of stuff now happening with Manchester United. Sheikh Jassim claiming, you know, it's an individual bid. It has nothing to do with the state.
Yeah, I think in the case of the Saudi public investment fund, that link is a lot closer.
Yeah.
With it being the official sovereign wealth fund. And similarly, Manchester City being owned by the literal deputy prime minister of the country, you know.
Mm-hmm. Who was at the Champions League final for the first time.
He was, I believe, the first time in 13 years that he'd seen Man City play. Yeah. Good
and that was Sheikh Mansour of the United Arab Emirates.
Yes, and his brother was also there, Mohammed bin Zayed, who is the president of the UAE. And, you know, they were sat next to President Erdogan of Turkey.
Right.
So you
were explaining, so this LIV Golf PGA Tour, they've been merged and the main investors are the Saudi investment firm.
Yes, exactly. So so LIV Golf was a competitor. The PGA Tour were very, very unhappy about the fact that LIV Golf was just coming along and just buying all its players, giving them insanely lucrative contracts. Actually, PGA Tour opened legal proceedings over LIV Golf for breach of contracts.
So this would be like another league setting up parallel to the Premier League and then buying all the best
players. Yeah, it was a bit of a shock, to be honest, a couple of weeks ago when the merger was announced, because before then, PGA Tour were actively criticizing the Saudis, you know, talking about the impact on, so the commissioner of the PGA Tour talked about the impact on 9/11 victims, who he'd spoken to, who were very upset about Saudi Arabia's involvement in golf because of their alleged link to 9/11, which the families claim. And the PGA Tour were talking about human rights abuses, and they were actively talking about sports washing in these kind of proceedings and in media appearances. So the fact that
now all of a sudden they've merged.
They've merged, and now the Public Investment Fund is the main investor in this new project is pretty mind-boggling.
Yeah, so, okay, this is Politics Uncensored, so we're really interested in the politics of it. Everything from Manchester United to Manchester City to Newcastle to now LIV Golf and PGA Tour, there is clearly, from the United Arab Emirates, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, there is clearly a strategy within the oil-rich Middle Eastern countries, states, to invest...
Oil and gas.
Oil and gas-rich states to invest in sports. Why?
So you know, you mentioned sports washing, and that's... that can be defined as kind of using sport to launder, to alter the reputation of whoever's doing the sports washing through you know, buying be it sports teams, be it sports organizers. It's about changing the conversation about these countries. So, you know, when we talk about Qatar, you know, when you see Qatar trending on Twitter, which it's trended a lot recently, you know, it's not really to do with the situation of migrant workers. It's not really to do with climate change and you know, the impact on that. It's usually to do with Man United or to do with PSG. And I think that's a key thing. You know, when people think about Qatar in recent times, they think about the World Cup. They think about Messi wearing the traditional Qatari bisht, you know, at the final. What a moment for sports washing. He literally lifted the World Cup with the kind of traditional dress on.
So this is an attempt by some of these states to kind of to clean their image on the global stage, essentially, by buying some of the most popular brands, some of the most popular parts of people's lives. Because it's not just, with at least with Saudi Arabia, it's not just football clubs. I mean, it is. Now, Cristiano Ronaldo was a big get for them. But there's all sorts of concerts that are going on that would have never seen the light of day 10 years ago. The WWE signed $100 million a deal, and they do regular pay-per-views out there. So there is. Absolutely, what you're saying is one of the strategies is they want, when people think Saudi Arabia, not to think Jamal Khashoggi. They want them to think WWE. They want them to think Beyonce. They want them to think Newcastle.
Absolutely. I mean, the UAE has invested a lot in literature. A lot of the biggest sort of literature festivals happen in the UAE. Saudi Arabia at the moment is investing a lot of money in Hollywood. You know, NEOM, which is their new multi-billion-dollar mega city that they're building, they're inviting filming production to take place there. And one of the impacts that has is that now production companies are very interested in Saudi money. There's a lot. There's a lot there. Yeah. You know, in investing in their shows, and that can have an impact on what we see on our TV. So I'll give you an example: The Dissident. Was a BAFTA-nominated documentary about the death of the Middle East Eye and Washington Post journalist Jamal Khashoggi, who was killed at the hands of Saudi agents. That film was directed by Brian Fogel, who won an Oscar. It should have been picked up by, there should have been a bidding wars, you know, by streaming services for this. In the end, it wasn't picked up by a Netflix or an Amazon Prime.
And that's potentially because of the amount of influence that Saudi will now have with the money that it's spreading around Hollywood?
Potentially, you know. You know, we've seen this, you know, with China, with comments that have been made by sports stars in the NBA or you know, by Mesut Ozil, mm-hmm. and the threat of the withdrawal of large yeah. amounts of funds, and that yeah. can have an impact.
So I want to ask two things. You're talking about the money. I'm really interested in the money, right? We've spoken about the social impacts mm-hmm. of the investment from some of these Middle Eastern states. What's the economic impact? A, you know, is this money that has been invited in the UK mm-hmm. or is it more of a hostile takeover? They've come and kind of taken advantage of the rules. And what is the economic, you know, is there an economic benefit for these states or is it an investment for social capital?
It's both. You know, sports washing is about kind of laundering reputations and improving reputations. But, you know, you always want to make money out of it. And in the case of Saudi Arabia, you know, they are trying to move away from oil reliance. Of course, a lot of the funds in the public investment fund come from their resources, but they are trying to diversify their portfolio by investing in sports, by investing in entertainment, and also lots of other companies, you know, Uber, Starbucks, and many other major companies that they've invested in. So it's about kind of diversifying their economy. But as you say, it's on the flip side for the British government, I wouldn't say it's hostile at all. I think, you know, a few months ago, some emails were released after a long battle, freedom of information battle, where I think The Athletic uncovered that the British government had kind of, I think pressured is the wrong word, but had spoken to the Premier League about what the benefits to the UK would be.
Oh, as a positive way to try and encourage sale of Newcastle.
Exactly, exactly. The importance of the relationship between the UK and Saudi Arabia. And, you know, the war in Ukraine has had a big impact on a lot of economies, including this one.
So I guess the point is maybe, I mean, and this is the politics of it all. I think sometimes things sports and politics are separate. They're not. The impact, one of the impacts of Brexit and the weakening economy, whether you think that's for Brexit or not, but one of the impacts of Brexit and our weakening economy is we've become so in need of injections of cash and capital that we are now essentially with a government is allegedly lobbying the Premier League to sell off our community assets. Some of the most important assets to people around the country were things like Newcastle United Football Club or Manchester United Football Club.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we mentioned Brexit, we mentioned, you know, the war in Ukraine and things like that. It's hard to get funding these days, but one place where there are huge amounts of funds are in these sovereign wealth funds, are in these states in the Middle East. And, you know, there was a time in sort of 2018 after the death of Jamal Khashoggi where Saudi Arabia became a bit of a pariah and they were struggling to
I remember Joe Biden as a candidate said he would make Saudi Arabia a pariah and then as president.
And then last year, you know, he was spudding MBS.
Yeah.
And
so the sports washing is working. I mean, it wouldn't have been all sports washing, but the sports washing is working.
Yeah,
like you're saying, Qatar is trending and it has nothing to do with migrant work.
Absolutely. And what the war in Ukraine showed was that when there is a political will to act on these things, actually the UK government has a lot of power. You know, Chelsea Football Club was taken away from Roman Abramovich because of his closeness to Vladimir Putin, who was at the time invading a neighboring country.
And you've seen that, I've seen that all over social media now, right? Where people are saying, when it's convenient, politics and sports intersect. Ukraine, for example, and like you said, Chelsea's football club. But when it's not convenient, Mesut Ozil was one that you mentioned, we're told that sports and politics should be kept separate.
Well, yeah, I mean, the UAE and Saudi Arabia have both been militarily involved in some form or other in a coalition that's accused of war crimes and of killing civilians in Yemen for nearly 8 years.
So the question, I guess the question I have, I have been going to Old Trafford since I was 9 years old. Mm-hmm. It's the first time I went. And it's been such an integral part of my life. And for me, I see Manchester United not as a global brand, not as something to be bought by a foreign state, but a community asset, a British community asset. It's been part of my life. And so my question to you, I'm going to ask you two questions first. The first question is, are we reaching a crunch point where the British state, the British government needs to act to protect these community assets as British assets? Because we don't know what these foreign states will do to them, right? You may run them brilliantly. What if they were to move Manchester United, like an American franchise, down to London, for example, or up to Edinburgh, for example, right? Are we reaching a crunch point where the British state is going to need to act, is going to need to regulate, or is it too far gone? And it's not just football we're talking about. We've been talking about golf. It could be in rugby and cricket.
Yeah.
Is there an intersection that we're reaching, or is it all gone and we're so desperate for money that...
Yeah, I mean, I think the example of kind of... assets being taken away from Russian oligarchs proves that you're never too far gone. You know, Abramovich owned Chelsea for a long time, 20 years. But when the political situation changed, that was taken away from him, and he had a lot of other assets, as did many other oligarchs. So when there is a political willingness to do something about it, things can change.
Yeah.
And the UK government has a lot of power over sports. And if they wanted to go for a similar model to Germany, the sort of 50+1 model,
yeah,
where you know, no kind of single entity can own, can have a majority share in a football club.
Yeah, that they could do that. They have the power to act. Listen, we're going to come back. Reyhan Uddin is going to stay with us in the studio because I'm really interested and I want to come back to this topic. But we have an even bigger story as it pertains to the British politics. And you've heard me talking about it both on this show and in different interviews over the last week. And that is that former Prime Minister Boris Johnson has been found to have deliberately misled Parliament over Partygate and would have been suspended for 90 days had he not resigned as a Member of Parliament earlier last week. And the Committee of MPs, which was the Privileges Committee, has found him guilty of misleading Parliament. And has recommended that Johnson should not be granted a former member's pass that MPs are usually entitled to. So when MPs leave Parliament, they're usually entitled to a pass that allows them back into the House of Commons. And he's been denied that right. This is unprecedented. A former Prime Minister resigning, having been found guilty of lying to the House of Commons by the Privileges Committee. A Privileges Committee which I might say has four members from the Conservative Party. And he has been forced to resign following what would have been a 90-day suspension from the House of Commons for misleading Parliament. We have joining us in a moment Christine Jardine, Liberal Democrat MP for Edinburgh West. Christine, can you hear us okay? Oh, I can't hear you. Can you hear me? Oh, there we go. I can hear you. Sorry, Christine. That was my fault. Thank you so much for joining us. We're talking now about Boris Johnson. This is unprecedented. A former Prime Minister resigning as a result of what he knew was coming, which is the Privileges Committee finding him guilty of misleading Parliament over Partygate. As an MP, can I just get your initial reaction? What's going on in the House of Commons? Is everyone running around with their hairs on fire? Is Nadine Dorries hunched over crying in the corner of some corridor? What's going on?
Well, there is a question. What is Nadine Dorries doing? She said she was resigning with immediate effect. And that was last week. Well, that's the best part of a week ago now. It was at the weekend.
Rumors are she's resigned with bated breath. I heard she's chained herself to the gates of the House of Commons, but this is just a rumor.
No. I was out there a little while ago and there's nobody chained.
Can I get your reaction to lying Boris leaving Parliament?
Well, it is, as you mentioned, it's unprecedented to have a Prime Minister found guilty by the Privileges Committee of having misled Parliament, lied to Parliament. And, you know, this should be the nail in his political career, final nail, because he has lied at a crucial time for the country when we were all living in with lockdown conditions, with COVID, threat to our health, threat to the NHS. People were not seeing loved ones in care homes for years. They weren't able to spend time with loved ones who were dying. Weddings were cancelled. Funerals were held in private. It's unthinkable that he had a party, which was against the rules for the rest of us, should have been against the rules for him and then misled us all about it. It was disrespect to people.
Yeah, and I'm really glad you've raised that, because he has a history of lying, but this wasn't lying about some personal indiscretion, having some sort of affair or something that you could say is outside the job. He lied having broken the rules in the most deadly pandemic, and the biggest public health crisis the country's faced. That's 200,000 people plus died around the country.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things I have said, and you don't have to agree with me though, is I think he's, you know, besides him resigning and besides him lying, and we've gotten rid of him, but it seems like he has injected a dangerous poison into our politics, which is the normalization of mistruths, of lying, of impropriety. Now, the standard of public office has drastically come down. Is that something you felt?
I think there's a danger that what he's done is encouraged people to think that we all behave like he did. And that's the biggest single danger in this, is that people will think that all politicians behave like Boris Johnson. He's undermined our democracy. Democracy is built on a social contract, which is all about agreement. It's all about faith. It's all about trust in your politicians, that they're representing you. And what he's done is undermined that potentially by lying and then doubling down on it, rather than being honest, and now making ludicrous claims about it all being a conspiracy.
A kangaroo court, he's called it today.
No, Boris, you did the wrong thing. You got caught. You have to acknowledge that and accept responsibility. And he's just not doing it.
Yeah. And so the other question I have is, look, one of the frustrations I've had is, you know, this wasn't out of character for Boris Johnson the moment he misled Parliament over Partygate. This is a man
who's... that's the division bill.
Right.
Sorry, ignore that. Sorry about that. What were you saying? I didn't quite hear you.
That's okay. I said the one of the frustrations I have with Boris and the way he has been treated is, this wasn't something out of character for him when he misled Parliament.
No.
He has been doing this consistently throughout his career, whether it was making up quotes as a journalist, whether it was being sacked as a minister by Michael Howard for lying about personal indiscretions, whether it was throwing £350 million on the side of a bus and leading us to Brexit, all the way to COVID. He has been a liar his entire career, and has been allowed to be a liar by the political system, by the media. Mm-hmm. And even, I remember Dawn Butler went up in Parliament, called him a liar, and was kicked out because it was against a convention. What kind of nonsense is this? When MPs were calling him a liar, when he was patently a liar, this archaic system threw him out. Surely this is part of the problem. The system has enabled Boris Johnson.
I don't think the system enabled Boris Johnson. I think, unfortunately, the Conservative Party enabled Boris Johnson, and I think they're ruining the day now, because having found him out, and he's now going, you know, he would have been suspended from Parliament anyway, and he is now doing his best to cause trouble for the Conservative Party. So I think you mentioned Dawn Butler there. There's a very good reason why we don't make accusations like that in Parliament. And that's because we have a privilege, which is that we can say what we like in Parliament. We're protected so that, you know, we can make accusations. And you
should But when someone's patently lied to the public, why is a member of Parliament not allowed to stand up and say so? That's part of the accountability.
It's now been proved that you lied, and the process had to be gone through, and it's been gone through, and that's the protection. That we've gone through this process, he's had to face these charges, and he's been found to have misled Parliament. And that's the protection. You have to make sure that you go through, it's like the law, you go through due process,
sure,
and people are tried properly. And that's why he's now been found out.
Yes, but that's if he lies in Parliament. The problem is, this man has been lying everywhere but Parliament for like 20 years, and that's what he was being called out on. My frustration is, the system is so archaic that it didn't even allow us to call a liar a liar, and he became Prime Minister.
The system is, like I said, it wasn't the system that made Boris Johnson Prime Minister. He became leader of the Conservative Party, and then he was elected. But we're responsible in Parliament for his, what's the word I'm looking for? Not controlling, but policing all of our behavior. Mm-hmm. And we have a code of conduct. And he rode roughshod over it. And he has now would have been suspended if, you know, the report is adopted on Monday, which I'm sure it will be. But the committee has ruled that he should be suspended for 90 days, which is unprecedented for a former prime minister for this to happen to them. And I think when it comes right down to it, Boris Johnson has been very good, if you like, at, through his career at sidestepping all these things, which you named, the being sacked as a minister. And he's been a sort of great manipulator and survivor. But this is it now. He is, you know, he has been found out. He has lied to the British public, which to me is the important thing. At a time when we were going through this crisis, which was the worst thing the country had faced since the Second World War, people, as you mentioned, were dying. We've all lost someone in this. We've all suffered. And the person we should have been looking to in this to make the right decisions and safeguard our well-being was Boris Johnson. It was the Prime Minister.
It was just one of those things of really having
wasn't doing it.
It was just one of those things of really having the wrong person at the wrong at the very worst time in power.
The other thing that has to happen now, though, is that as a former Prime Minister, he's entitled to more than 100,000 a year for life.
Is that true? I had no idea. Is that a thing?
Yep. That's what he's entitled to. And what we want is for Rishi Sunak to say, no, you're not getting it, Boris. And for that to be stopped. Also, I think the money that the taxpayer paid out for his legal fees, because he had his legal fees paid for, we should get back. Because he has let the country down. He has abused our trust in him as Prime Minister when he was Prime Minister. And I think that the taxpayer should get that money back.
You're absolutely... I'm really glad. I had no idea of that. And I'm really glad you've mentioned that, because now what I would do is listen to every listener watching, listening, whether it's live or on demand, to write to your MPs and make sure that they do something to make sure that this man does not receive... what is it, £100,000 a year for the rest of his life, having misled us into a deadly pandemic. Christine, I know we don't have you for much longer. I just have a couple of questions more.
Sure.
I agree with you. I think this is him done. I'm more optimistic about the British public. I don't think they will allow him back. A snap YouGov poll found that even Conservative Party members thought him resigning, I think 62%, was the right thing to do. My concern is... Boris Johnson is gone, but he has left behind him acolytes that will continue this style of politics. The likes of Jacob Rees-Mogg, I know Nadine Dorries has left, but Suella Braverman and others, there's still some really dangerous individuals, in my view, who engage in, if not the same, similar styles of politics to Boris Johnson. Is that something that we need to be more vigilant of now and take action on?
Well, there's two things. First of all, we need a general election, and then... people will have the opportunity to vote those people out or to make sure that they're not in government. That's the first thing. The second thing is that there is a battle going on within the Conservative Party at the moment. So I think you get good people in all parties, because everybody goes into politics because they want to make a difference. It's how they want to make a difference that is, the, you know, which policies they would follow to make a difference for people. They all want to make society better. And, you know, people in the Conservative Party are unhappy about what has happened. So there's a kind of battle going on within the Conservative Party now for the sort of heart and soul. Where do they go? Do they go further to the right? Do they go down a sort of Boris Johnson, Jacob Rees-Mogg path? Or do they go back to a sort of more smaller liberal conservatism? But the big thing is we need a general election, and the public can make sure that these people are not in power.
Yeah, and that's I think that's really right. You know, one of the things I've learned in politics is the only way to hold these people accountable is to take power away from them, because that's really all they care about. A general election truly is the way to do that, and I agree with you. And I think one is coming, actually. Even if one isn't called early, we're not that far away from one. Christine, last thing I'm going to ask you, be honest with me now. What are the Liberal Democrats' chances in the next general election? Don't spin me.
General election or the by-election?
General election
coming up in Mid Bedfordshire.
Oh, let's do Mid Bedfordshire first. Do you think you guys have a chance?
Well, Mid-Bedfordshire, we've shown in by-elections up and down the country over the last couple of years that we can upset the Conservative apple cart, if you like. We can make sure that we send a message to them that they're doing the wrong things.
But didn't you come third in Bedfordshire last time? Wouldn't it be better to just stand
third in North Shropshire, I think, before the by-election that we won. So, you know, don't look too closely at that. It's about, you know, whether we have the right policies for the people in that area and whether they want an MP who will work hard for them, as Liberal Democrat MPs do. And when it comes to the general election, we will be targeting those seats where we think we can make a difference. Where if people don't want a Conservative government, they can vote for us. And that will be, you know, a change, and they will have an MP who will work for them. And there's something like 80 seats, more than 80 seats in the south of England, all across England, where we're in second place, and we can beat the Conservatives.
Do you think the context of the political situation we're in, given that Boris Johnson has set fire to the Conservative Party and looks like he's intent on burning it down on his way out, could we see a potential alliance, whether formal or informal, between Labour and Lib Dems, or no?
We will be targeting the seats that we think we can win, and some of them are Labour seats. And in Scotland, we'll be targeting SNP seats and Labour seats. Well, there's only one Labour seat.
That's a no, then.
So Labour seats in England, SNP seats in Scotland, Conservative seats in both.
So that's a no.
For us, it's about winning as many seats as we possibly can and having as big an influence in the next Parliament.
Is that a no? I used to do these kind of answers, Christine. Tell me, is that a no or a yes? You really don't think that there's going to be any sort of formal alliance between Liberal Democrats and Labour?
No, we're looking over however long we have till the general election. If Rishi does
I think that's the right move. Yeah, I know there's a lot of pressure for it. As a progressive, I actually think that's the right move. We, you know, both parties present their case to the public, and then whatever happens after the results happens. But I don't think any alliance going into it is the right thing. So I agree with you on that.
I think it's almost insulting to the public to say, oh, we'll have an alliance with this party, because you're not giving them the choice.
No, present your case and then we'll decide everything afterwards.
Yeah, exactly. Christine,
thank you so much. That was Christine Jarding, Liberal Democrat MP for Edinburgh West, who's brought some really insightful stuff, not least telling me that apparently Prime Ministers get over £100,000, near £100,000 after, and has confirmed to me that Nadine Dorries has not chained herself to the doors of the House of Commons. Christine, thank you so much for joining us. Coming up next, we have a huge guest, Lord Heseltine, former Deputy Prime Minister under John Major, Conservative peer, and a veteran of the Conservative Party, will be joining me to discuss Boris Johnson, the Conservative Party, and the future for our country. He's going to be joining us after this.
FUBAR Radio presents As Handsome As You Imagine.
What did you have for breakfast that morning?
Almost certainly a pie.
For breakfast?
Yeah, because we started really, really early, right, at the butcher's. Yeah. We started proper early, like 7 o'clock. I would have had at least 6 pies.
A day?
A day.
That is a lot of pies.
No, because we sold them at the shop.
That is a legitimate answer to the question, who ate all the pies? Yeah.
From 1 p.m. every Monday.
Welcome back. This is Ali Milani for Politics Uncensored. We have been talking about Boris Johnson's bombshell resignation as a result of the Privileges Committee. Former Prime Minister have been found to mislead Parliament. We are now joined by a veteran of the Conservative Party, a former Deputy Prime Minister under John Major, and a Tory peer. Funnily enough, I mispronounced this earlier on. We had Lord Heseltine on the phone earlier to discuss with us the findings of the Privileges Committee and whether he thinks how damaging this could be for the Conservative Party. Lord Heseltine, thank you so much for joining us. We've been talking about the unprecedented report from the Privileges Committee that has found Boris Johnson did indeed mislead Parliament, and if he was to stay on as a Member of Parliament, would have been suspended for, again, an unprecedented 90 days. What do you make of this bombshell finding from the Privileges Committee?
Well, it's not really much of a surprise, is it? Because it's been extensively leaked over the last 3 days. And dramatically, escalated by Boris Johnson's decision to forestall the findings by leaving Parliament. And I think all of us who watch these events with a certain curiosity, shall we say, politely, realize that he conducted a brilliant coup de théâtre. He was under deep apprehension as to what the report was going to say. It's probably worse than his worst fears. And rather than stay and take the flak, he not only attacked the committee in a wholly reprehensible way, but got out so that any penalty they could recommend was irrelevant. The point I made about his attack on the committee was a pack of lies. I mean, this committee is a select committee of the House of Commons with a Conservative majority, with the ability to recommend to Parliament anything that it feels appropriate. It's to Parliament who makes the decision, but Boris Johnson was not prepared to allow Parliament to have that opportunity. And so he got out from under. But the serious issue, of course, is that he lied to Parliament. And I'm afraid this is a much bigger issue than the result of the COVID inquiry, which is all wrapped up in the Select Committee report, because the really disastrous issue of our time is Brexit. And that, again, was masterminded by Boris Johnson, who told a pack of lies.
Yes, and I guess this is one of the things we've been talking about, as well as the findings of the Privileges Committee. Boris Johnson's relationship with the truth and his propensity for impropriety and lies in public office. I wonder what you think that has had, what kind of impact that's had on our politics and the strength of our political institutions.
Well, I think it has done. The Brexit decision, which is, as I've said, is based on a pack of lies, has done great harm to our economy. It has done great harm to our international reputation as a sane, practical, well-run country. And it has done unforgivable damage to the aspirations of a younger generation who've seen themselves cut off from the centre of power of the world power grouping of Europe, of which we are a fundamental part.
And so do you think that this is the case where whoever the next prime minister is, as well as Rishi and the future of foreign affairs, but also institutions here at home, is there a rebuilding job to be done after Boris? Because he has really wrecked our reputation around the world and with voters here at home.
Well, I think we must be fair to the present Prime Minister. He has brought sanity back to the conduct of our affairs. But he is a prisoner of the Brexit movement within the Conservative Party. And it seems evident to me that all the other political leaders are in the same sort of bind, that they are frightened of the effect that Brexit has had, particularly in what are known as the bedwall seats north of Birmingham, who've been told that the fault of Britain's demise is all about immigrants and Brussels and the forms that people have to fill in and all these things. And to turn around and try and tell people that that is, quite frankly, a gross misrepresentation of the truth is a huge reversal of political strategy, and the leaders of our parties are running away from it. But they will have to embrace it, particularly as the younger generation are frustrated by where we are and know perfectly well that any sane government would be seeking to restore our relationship with Europe.
Yes, and you spoke about, you know, Rishi Sunak's attempts to kind of distance himself from Boris and change the perception. The reality is, even now, there are many in the Conservative Party who continue to defend Boris. And much like Donald Trump in America, although sometimes I find the links difficult to make, but much like Donald Trump, it seems the Conservative Party has changed, given that it's not just Boris Johnson. He has now left the scene. But people like Nadine Dorris, Jacob Rees-Mogg, you know, there are a lot of members of Parliament, prominent members of the Conservative Party, that are within that sort of Boris realm. And so is there difficulty in being able to recover this, given that he, you know, some of his acolytes continue to exist within the Conservative Party. And, you know, you are a veteran of the Conservative Party. Is this party recognisable to the one that you served under?
That is a very difficult question for people like me. I think the headline answer is no, because I worked for the Conservative Party since the days of Winston Churchill and on through Eric Douglas Hume and Ted Heath, of course, Harold Millen as well, and Margaret Thatcher and John Major, and indeed through to the time I spent working for David Cameron. And there is no comparison between the sort of sanity of those prime ministers and their pursuit of national self-interest and the lunacy of the greatest political mistake of the last half century. I mean, to believe that you can prosper by cutting off your biggest marketplace, how can any sane person believe that? Unless they were told that there were all sorts of opportunities in the rest of the world, which patently there aren't. And every day that goes by, and let's be frank, it's now 7 years since the Brexiteers became the principal force in government, not on the backbenches, not in the newspapers, in government. They've been there for 7 years, and they've failed to give any substance to the promises on which they got elected.
Yeah, and I think, look, even Nigel Farage, who was the bastion of Brexit, certainly before the referendum and during, has admitted on TV that Brexit hasn't worked. If you were advising Rishi Sunak, which I don't know you may be doing, what would your advice be to him to do next?
Well, first I would say to him, don't get into the punch-up with Boris Johnson. A, you won't win, because he will sling ever larger lumps of mud. And unfortunately, there are newspapers only too happy to carry in their headlines this sort of low-level political abuse. And I'm afraid the Daily Mail and the Daily Telegraph are now still giving Boris Johnson airtime and fanning the flames. And as long as they keep doing that, Boris Johnson will keep providing the wherewithal for their headlines. So what I think Rishi Sunak has to do, which he started doing, is governing sanely, truthfully, and explaining to people just how difficult and lonely the British position is. Now, he has this huge problem that the Brexit element of the Conservative Party don't like that, and will make very noisy interruptions at every stage, damaging to the party and to our electoral prospects. Rishi Sunak has to show the leadership and the dignity to rise above this level of internecine warfare and to show that he's trying to tackle the real problems in ways which will, in the end, command respect.
Okay, and last question to you. I'm really appreciative of your time. Our last question would be, do you think, given everything that has happened around Boris Johnson, the failure of Liz Truss's premiership, do you think the Conservative Party has a chance of winning the next general election?
Well, nobody is going to look at the present opinion polls and the local authority results and give you a simple yes answer to that question. It is difficult to see what the outcome of the next general election is. I don't believe that the evidence is there to show that there's going to be an overall Labour majority. There may be, but at the moment, I don't think there's evidence that would frighten me if I was advising anyone on the subject. I think it's containable, but equally, it will require... And this is in the light of the very difficult economic circumstances we're facing, with rising interest rates and inflation at unacceptable levels. It is very difficult to see how the Conservatives pull back to a position of power after the election.
Do you think Rishi Sunak can lead them to a victory?
I believe that in the end they will recover their prime position in British democracy. But they're in a very difficult position at the moment.
Just quick follow-up. Do you think Rishi Sunak is can be a viable candidate for prime minister on a ballot paper for the Conservative Party? Do you think he'll be an asset or perhaps a weakness?
I have no doubt that he is an asset to the Conservative Party. And as I keep repeating, he has brought sanity back to the conduct of our affairs. You feel he is a man of integrity. You may not agree with everything that he says. I don't agree with his Brexit views. But I can see a hard-working man who understands the scale of the problems and is devoting himself with energy to find coherent solutions. And against the background where he will, is telling people a very substantial part of the truth about our position.
Okay, thank you so much. That was Lord Heseltine, former Deputy Prime Minister under John Mayer, a Conservative peer and a veteran of the Conservative Party. Lord Heseltine, thank you so much for joining us.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. We're back in the studio now. Rayhan, we've heard from Lord Heseltine. We've heard from Christine Jarding, Liberal Democrat MP for Edinburgh West. I wonder, you know, as a journalist, this idea of the erosion of trust, the blatant lying, you have to interview sources, you have to deal with government sources. Mm-hmm. How much harder is that, knowing that there's just much more willingness to lie in our politics now than there used to be?
Yes, I think in my experience, you know, with, like you say, speaking to kind of governments and things like that, we're not necessarily sort of directly lied to in that same kind of way. It's more a case of questions are fudged, you know, deflection, things aren't answered, you know, to the fullest extent, or, you know, we can't know about things for, be it national security reasons or what have you. And sometimes it's not the case of being lied to, but it's about not getting the truth.
Do you think trust is at an all-time low in our politics? Not even as a journalist, just as a voter, speaking to family members, friends, things like that. Has it always, like, are people more of the sense of they lie to us all the time, things like that, or has it always been this way?
I think in terms of kind of trust and the truth, to me, yeah, as someone looking at it, it seems as though it's not necessarily about the truth, but more about the narrative. And I think we're seeing this with, you know, Boris Johnson talking about a kangaroo court, you know, with regards to the Privileges Committee. And, you know, Trump has used similar language. Mm-hmm.
He also got indicted, yeah.
Yeah, and I think it's quite common to sort of talk about a conspiracy against you and a conspiracy against, you know, these, be they populist leaders and politicians, but also commentators. And I think social media can exacerbate this.
Yeah. It's funny. I'm just going to interrupt you. You said that because when we talk about Trump and things like that, I had I was picking up my brother-in-law from hospital not too long ago. Just a couple of days, maybe a day ago. And obviously he grew up most of his life in Iran.
Okay.
And in the Middle East, and spent a lot of time in Kuwait. Mm-hmm. And he said, you know, I thought I was coming to Britain and we were going to get normal politics.
Yeah.
But now you've got a prime minister who's been found to have misled parliament and has resigned.
Yeah.
You've got Nicola Sturgeon up north getting arrested. You've got Trump in America getting arrested. This is just like Middle Eastern politics all over again, no?
Yeah, no, exactly. It's true. And I think, you know, the point I was kind of thinking about with social media, especially with since Elon Musk's takeover of Twitter and the sort of change in the algorithm, essentially, like who can be verified. You know, with some of the news I cover in the Middle East, it's very often we see these disinformation networks originating from, you know, various countries in the Middle East where they push out the lines of these, be they dictators, be they populist leaders. And so, you know, you have a situation where they're essentially the foot soldiers. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they're not even real people.
Yeah. And that's interesting because when we talk about sports washing, which we spoke to you about earlier in the show, social media plays a huge role in it because now, and I would urge anyone listening to just search on Twitter, Qatar Man United or Saudi Newcastle, and you will see, I mean, you never know who it is, but Manx with Qatari flags in their bios and in their names.
Yeah.
You'll see Geordies with Saudi flags.
Yeah.
in their names. You went up to Newcastle and you saw them dressed up in thobes.
Yeah,
and,
I did a piece when the takeover.
So the sports washing is working.
It was first announced, and yeah, I mean, I've never seen so many
Geordies and thobes,
kefirs, yeah, on people's heads. But you know, you're right. Social media is a kind of very direct form of sports washing. You know, sometimes these cultural things, the way reputations are laundered, it's not as direct, you know. Mm. It takes time for us to see it, whereas you literally have fans changing their names on Twitter to include a Qatari flag, mm-hmm, or a Saudi flag in the case of Newcastle United fans.
Not really seen the same with Man City.
Yeah, it's true. I think firstly, like, that was announced in 2008, you know. Yeah. Social media kind of has moved on. A lot of time we see it at the beginning, you know, when they want the takeover to happen. I remember when reporting on the Newcastle takeover, people were literally making, Newcastle fans were making TikToks, mm-hmm, with Mohammed bin Salman, you know, kind of strutting around and, yeah, sort of the powerful music in the background. But this is a man who was officially found by the US to have been responsible for the murder of Jamal Khashoggi.
Yeah. In Newcastle, all anyone knows is he's taken us to fourth or third or...
Exactly, yeah. So to make a TikTok about this guy, you know, fans need to do some soul searching, I suppose, in terms of being the foot soldiers of.
And listen, this is what I would say to Manchester United fans. I'm a season ticket holder. I've been going to Old Trafford since I was 9 years old. I fell in love with Manchester United because of the sort of phoenix story of coming out of the Munich air disaster, and the fact that a football club could rebuild after tragedy using its youth. And one of the things I'm most proud of United is, you know, is its culture of cultivating young, often Mancunians, into football. And I didn't want estate ownership. I didn't want my football club to become a laundering vehicle for the reputation and the economy of a foreign state, no matter what that state was. Mm-hmm. I don't care if it's America, I don't care if it's Qatar, I don't care if it's China. Mm-hmm. And I really think, you know, there's a lot of fans out there now who are thinking, oh great, there's more transfer spend, we might win something, but at what cost is the question. So we talked about social media a lot and people putting Qatari flags. We're going back to Boris Johnson. We've heard from Lord Heseltine, we've heard from Christine from the Liberal Democrats, you've heard from me, you've heard from Rayhan, but now I want to hear from real people. So our wonderful studios put on their, our wonderful producers put on their best shoes, took a nice cold bottle of water out there into the sweltering heat of Islington, and they asked people on the streets who should be Boris Johnson's replacement.
Anyone would be better than Boris.
I don't think anybody is suitable within the current clusterfuck of a government that we have. So, certainly the revolting cronyism in the Tory party is something that, you know, I wouldn't want to have any of them doing that. So someone completely new, let's have a general election. That's my opinion.
Someone that actually gives a fuck. That would be my answer. I think too many people get into politics for the wrong reasons. And someone young, someone dynamic, probably someone that doesn't exist yet.
Maybe Jacqueline Walker. You know, I feel like she contributed a lot to the whole Labour Party, and especially Momentum. I think she's a good role model, good activist. So I think, probably her.
So I think Barack Obama, he's just a great guy, great charisma, great wife. Like, it's the whole package. And I think that's what we need right now. Like, someone professional.
I think just somebody that we can trust to be honest and credible, and that, you know, we would be proud to see running our country, really.
Good old David Beckham. He's got good fashion. He's got good sense. Maybe he'll make him look a bit better in Parliament.
Someone get Barack Obama and David Beckham on the next Ryanair flight from New York to London to make them Prime Minister. I think, Ray, what you heard there was just people really frustrated with the current system, so they're looking for anyone up to David Beckham to change things. What's your response to that? I mean, you know what's interesting about that, actually, is one of the things we accused Boris Johnson of was the sort of style over substance. He's very entertaining and he equals clicks and views. There is a real sense of like entertainment value in there in our politics. And that's something that I think when you hear things like Barack Obama and David Beckham,
I mean,
I have no idea who Jacqueline Walker even is, but
I mean, someone suggested David Beckham, we've seen these examples, you know. Zelensky literally played a president.
Yes, yeah.
You know, on TV, and you know, one of the Klitschko brothers is a mayor. We have Imran Khan in Pakistan. You know, literally was the captain of the cricket team. And I think this kind of well-known public figure, be it in sport, being in acting, like it's something that we're seeing all across the world in lots of different countries. And I guess it begs the question, are people moving away from sort of career
experts,
politicians?
Yeah. And look, this will be my sort of closing rant for this show. And what we have to do now is take responsibility for Boris Johnson. Boris Johnson as an individual did what Boris Johnson does, and that's him looking out for number one, making sure that his political career thrived and survived. But the responsibility on all of us, now that he is leaving the arena, is to analyze how someone who, like I mentioned earlier, had falsified quotes as a journalist, had lied about an affair and been sacked as a minister, had come out with extraordinary comments, homophobic comments, Islamophobic comments, racist comments, comments about single mothers, would then become the mayor of London and have disastrous things like the garden project that cost, I think, £40 million or something in that regard to the taxpayer and was never built, would then lead the Brexit charge with that £350 million lie on the side of a bus, would then become prime minister and lead us into a disastrous COVID response, and then mislead Parliament over Partygate, which is him breaking his own rules. He has continuously failed upwards because the media has allowed it, because the media chose clicks and views over truth and accountability. The system has allowed it because Parliament was far more obsessed with its archaic rules of not being able to clap in that damn chamber and not being able to call a lie a lie. Even Christine Jordan still was trying to defend these archaic rules that belong in the 15th century. The system has allowed him to succeed. And if we don't learn from those mistakes, I guarantee you the likes of Jacob Rees-Mogg, the likes of Nadine Dorries, and his acolytes will continue to fan the flames of this divisive politics to get ahead. And you can see that with the boats now. And even Rishi Sunak, who I think Lord Heseltine was very, very kind to, is being held hostage to the far right of his party. He was pictured today laughing at with his sort of stab-proof vest jacket talking about boats. And so the system really needs to reflect on how Boris Johnson wasn't just created out of nothing. It was created by the media, by the political system, and allowed to succeed. We are reaching the end of the show. Thank you guys all so much. We've had such a big big vast array of topics that we've spoken about today. I want to give a big thanks to Lord Heseltine, former Deputy Prime Minister under John Major, not Mayor. John Major is apparently a singer, I've been told. John Major, Conservative peer and veteran Conservative politician who spoke to us about Boris Johnson. Christine Jarding, Liberal Democrat MP for Edinburgh West, who spoke to us and taught us, by the way, that it's not £100,000, it's £115,000 the former Prime Ministers get. And Liz Truss is apparently receiving that money, having done 10 minutes work in number 10. And Rehan Uddin, journalist from Middle East Eye, who's talking to us about sports washing, Saudi, Qatar, Emiratis, golf. I've learned a lot about golf. Rehan, where can people find you?
I'm on Twitter, @Ray_Uddin. Rehan was taken, unfortunately. on the Middle East Eye website, you can find my work.
And you can find Rehan's work. He's done work on, he went up to Newcastle with the Saudi purchase of Newcastle. You were at the World Cup. Before the World Cup, you were at Qatar before the World Cup, reporting on the migrant crisis out there. So Rehan, thank you so much for joining us. And you can keep in touch with Politics Uncensored. Follow us on Instagram @PoliticsUncensored. We are now on Twitter. We have a new Twitter account. Please follow us @PoliticsFubar. I am Ali Milani @AliMilaniUK. Thank you so much for joining us for another episode of Politics Uncensored. We will join you same time, same place next week. Thank you so much, everybody. Salams.